All right. So tonight, beginning our basic Buddhist teachings series, I've kind of done this series before. I called it foundational teachings, which is kind of more appropriate in a way, but foundational is a little similar to like fundamental, is a little similar to, I don't know. So it sounds a little just a tad creepy. So yeah, basic Buddhist teachings is just more friendly. So yeah, I'm hoping that we will have time for just questions and discussion. I have the basic outline of the class on the website for the next 8 weeks until August. But I am probably going to massage the schedule as we go, basically covering, you know, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Dukkha, blah, you know, all that stuff. But depending on, like I was going to just start off with Dukkha tonight, but then I decided to understand Buddhism, it's really helpful to understand with the Buddha's, start with the Buddha's story, to start with the story of Shakyamuni Buddha, kind of as archetype and as teaching. There's a lot communicated just in kind of the myth of his story that is very helpful setup. So, but people have been asking me if I have a recommendation for a book. And to some extent, my answer is that book doesn't exist yet. I'm thinking of compiling it as I put together this class, because I have a lot of the content already on the podcast website, but I need to massage it in certain ways. Like I have like four episodes on the Buddha's life. And obviously, you know, we don't need to go into that level of detail for what I'm talking about tonight. But I did actually just notice in our library, this is a very, very old book. First published 1959. And it is Walpola Rahula, What the Buddha Taught. And it is very, I mean, it's kind of dated in its writing perhaps, but it's pretty solid and quite concise. There's a lot of presentations of the Buddha's teachings, including one by Thich Nhat Hanh, which is fine, but it's also kind of interpretive. And when you're going to put together, you know, a volume like this, like, what do you pick? The Buddha taught a lot of stuff. What's the most important things to concentrate on? So this is pretty good because of the Buddhist attitude of mind. And he does the Four Noble Truths, each one. He talks about dukkha and anatta and all of this stuff. And he has translations of some of the core Pali canon suttas in the, you know, that's the like the second part of it. So it's quite useful and should be actually quite cheap after all this time. Brian.
It's online. I was looking at it today. So you can get it by going into Google. It's free. You can just look it up. It's all the chapters there.
Oh, the yep. This one?
Yeah, yes. I was looking at it today. Oh. So it's online.
Yeah, all available for free at this point. But if you do want a physical book, it is available. So the Buddha's life and kind of what each of the parts are telling us. I'm not going to go into, like I said, my podcast episodes go into a lot more detail. There's detail about like his mother and her pregnancy and the circumstances of his birth. And it's all very, the story is very mythological in tone. And so I should say a note about just the historicity, the historical accuracy of what we know about the Buddha, which is very little. We have texts We have the Pali Canon, which is the preserved texts of the Theravadin school, some other older lineages. We have the Jataka tales, which aren't canonical, but they're kind of like, the Jataka tales are much more, they're much more colorful and fun. So a lot of the more, the more fairy tale like mythological imagery and stories comes from the Jataka tales. But I really like this quote in terms of whether any of this is true or whether the Buddha ever existed or whatever doesn't really matter for the purposes that we're talking about it here. So this is a quote from Joseph Campbell, who famously, you know, wrote and talked about myth. Said, myths are the body of stories and legends that a people perceive as being an integral part of their culture. Before the invention of writing, these stories and legends were handed down from generation to generation in the form of rituals and oral traditions. The reappearance of certain themes time and again in different mythologies leads to the realization that these themes portray universal and eternal truths about mankind. So, in fact, the Jataka tales and the Pali Canon were orally transmitted for about 500 years after the Buddha's death. So this definitely, accuracy and historicity and all of that, we have a very different standard of that from all of that. So I'm just kind of piecing together between Pali Canon sources and the Jataka tales. There are later versions which are even more embellished, and I'm not using those. But so many of you know the story of the Buddha, but essentially, he was born in India to it's often described as he was a prince and his father was a king and whatever. But that's unlikely at that time. He was just of the ruling class. Of the ruling caste, and they must have been wealthy and whatever. So, you know, it was he was a prince of sorts. And apparently, shortly after his birth, a seer, you know, took a look at the child and kind of, you know, was able to see his future. And the seer said that he would become a great spiritual teacher, that he would, touch the ultimate self-awakening. So he would be a self-awakened spiritual seeker, and then he would become a great teacher. And his father, Suddhodana, didn't really like that idea. because at this time, Buddhism arose, and it was a very rich spiritual time. There were many, many different spiritual paths and traditions and holy men and meditators and ascetics and shramanas, and the forest was full of spiritual teachers and seekers. But there was a strong tradition of like leaving home and going off and like, you know, living in the woods and seeking your spiritual path. So this is definitely not what Siddhartha's father wanted him to do. He wanted to, you know, stay home and, you know, whatever, take on the family business or whatever. So Siddhartha was, you know, spoiled and kept in luxury and insulated from any kind of suffering or discomfort. You know, he's portrayed as being almost imprisoned in, you know, a series of palaces. They might move to a different palace each season, but, and they, you know, the extreme mythology says like, the servants even went around and removed flowers once they had, you know, were starting to die, so that he never even saw that. He was very insulated from all of this. But nonetheless, he became curious about the wider world. And when in this story, he asked his charioteer, Chana, to take him on a trip through the city. And on his first trip, he saw a very, very old person. Never seen a really old person before. And so he asked his charioteer, like, what's wrong with that person? The charioteer explains, that's a very old person, and we're all going to get old. So this was a shock to Siddhartha. And then on the next trip, so the story goes, they saw a very sick person. Similarly, he finds out, yeah, you know, we're all probably going to get sick. Then he goes out and he ends up seeing a corpse, which in India, they're out. And you can see them anywhere. And so similarly, he was like, what's wrong with that person? And like, well, and we're all going to die. So suddenly, you know, he's got this, you know, all these spiritual questions. And then on the fourth trip, he saw a holy man, a Shramana, who was, you know, quiet, sitting quietly and peacefully in meditation. So he ends up telling his own story later in the Pali Canon. And he says, at this point, he recognized ignorant people are horrified, humiliated, and disgusted when they encounter old age, disease, and death, as if they themselves weren't also subject to them. And he said his intoxication with youth and health and life dropped away at that point. And he saw the path of renunciation as rest. He wondered how beings might be able to find true peace when life was so fleeting, and this was in store for us. So there's many ways to phrase his spiritual question, but essentially it was the question of suffering. Are we just doomed to kind of ride the winds of fate, right? As long as everything's going great, we're happy, but then, you know, disaster strikes, loss happens, and then we're devastated. And then are we just kind of subject to that? Is there anything we can do about that? Is there any peace, true peace, that we can find? So not much longer after these questions awakened, he decided to leave home on his spiritual quest. And he snuck out in the middle of the night with the assistance of his good charioteer, and at a safe distance from the palace, he cut off his hair and exchanged his fancy clothes for some simple ones, and then set off to be a holy man in the woods. So for this part, I mean, there's many, and I'm going to open this up too. And if any of you see some other teachings or messages in this story, feel free to join in. But my real takeaway is spiritual suffering can arise in us no matter what our circumstances are. And this was actually very, very important to me personally. You know, when I came to Buddhism, I was 24 and I felt really, really neurotic. From the outside, it looked like I was coping just fine, but I felt like life was pretty pointless. We were all on a conveyor belt to death. Well, what was the real point? And I felt neurotic and I felt like I had bad habits and I couldn't do anything about them. And I don't know. But I felt like I had no excuse for feeling that way, right? I was fortunate. I had everything I needed. I had no excuse. But then here I encounter this story of the Buddha. And I mean, he had no excuse either, right? He was in, you know, luxurious, peaceful, perfect circumstances. And yet this arose. So I think that's a very valuable message. This isn't a term that's commonly used in Buddhism, but it is from the Theravadan tradition. And I think it's really useful. There's a term called samvega. It's an emotion, and it's difficult to describe. This is one of my favorite Theravadan monks, Tanisaro Bhikkhu. He said, samvega is a hard word to translate because it covers such a complex range, at least three clusters of feelings at once. So this is what I'm thinking Shakyamuni Buddha experienced. This is what I experienced when I was 24 and it led me to Buddhism. Said, so three feelings of clusters of feelings at once. The oppressive sense of shock, dismay, and alienation that comes from realizing the futility and meaninglessness of life as it's normally lived. A chastening sense of our own complicity, complacency, and foolishness in having let ourselves live so blindly. And an anxious sense of urgency in trying to find a way out of the meaningless cycle. So, in response to Samvega, which some of us feel this, many people don't apparently feel this. You can't really know for sure, right? But it certainly seems like some people out there are like, I don't know, this life is cool, I'm fine with the way things are going. It is, I know, it's a very cathartic feeling if you feel Samvega and you encounter other people who do, right? And you know you are not like crazy. So in response to Samvega, if it arises, some beings become very depressed or try to distract themselves or numb out or something. I mean, what are you supposed to do with this? But sometimes a determination to find a better way to live arises. And so in Mahayana Buddhism, we call this bodhicitta. Samvega in Theravada is paired with pasada, which is a determination to find the way. Or it can be called bodhicitta, way-seeking mind. And is deeply valued and viewed as an essential prerequisite to spiritual practice. Like if that didn't arise, you wouldn't seek a way and you wouldn't find a way. And the way that we look at it in Buddhism, you cannot make this arise in someone. It's kind of a mystery. We don't really know why it arose in us. Why did we respond in this way? Why did we respond to that kind of that? I mean, dissatisfaction is not quite the right word because we don't want to. It's not exactly the same thing as dukkha, but it's somewhat related. So. But that dissatisfaction arising, there's just this sense that like, I don't know, there's got to be a better way. And to respond to that with like, and I'm going to find it. And I feel like that kind of faith and determination, that can build over time as we get confirmation from a path that we found, like, yeah, this works and seems to be right, seems to be helping. But maybe at first, I think of it as just kind of like really desperate wishful thinking. You know, it's just like, gotta be a way. If there's a way, I'm gonna find it. Like, just, you're not even sure there's a way. And if anybody questions you, you're not necessarily that confident, but just, you have an intuition that there's a way. So I will pause there before going on with the Buddha's story. Any comments or questions or other things that you, other messages that you see in this part of the Buddha's story? And if anybody wants to say anything here, you get to come up into the questioner chair. So that the folks in the cloud can see you. Marv.
Thanks. I have two comments. One point that's usually not made in about the four messengers. It's often told that the seer, Atisha, said he'd either be a great world leader, which his father wanted because the Shakyas were subject to another state, the Kosala. So he wanted to get out of their budgets. But it was precisely by preventing Siddhartha from seeing anything upsetting that when he did, it was such a shock that it changed him. So actually, his father made it happen. That's one thing. The other thing, it's often the way it's told, the shock and then seeing a path with the Shramana, what I've never seen really emphasized is that it could be that he was very concerned with old age, sickness, and death, and seeking an answer, not just for himself, but he could have immediately have had bodhicitta, compassion for all beings, aroused by seeing a sick man, by seeing an old man, and by seeing, he mentioned specifically the grieving mourners over the dead body. He could have gone on all of this quest, not just for himself, right from the start.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely get a sense from his search. I mean, it didn't say explicitly, but like, I don't know, he wasn't just seeking a, he was seeking a path that would be relevant for everyone. I saw other hands up, but then they got put down. So. Paulette.
I don't know if I want to follow Marv, but anyway, it reminds me, I just finished teaching Catcher in the Rye, and it just, like what you just talked about. You know, I hadn't read it since I was a teenager, and I read it again, and I was like, why did I like this book so much? So, but it made so much sense to me when I read it as a teenager, and it, I think it's like some of what you were just talking about, which is like having everything you need and still feeling that sense of dissatisfaction and not knowing why, and, you know, and just feeling like something's off. And I think that book does a really good job of expressing that with the main character. It's just, I see so many, you know, because I teach English, I see so many overlaps. Yeah. And it's hard for me not to bring Buddhism into everything that I talk about in class, but, you know, but I can't. But there's just so many, like, connections to this story and to, you know, the things that we talk about.
Yeah.
In the Sangha.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. You're right. And it is something that, like, often teenagers encounter. And I definitely felt like my first spiritual education was in my English class. You know, just got me thinking in ways that nothing else ever had. Jim, would you check and see if we're like cooling this room to like 69? Feel like that to me right now, but maybe it's just me. All right. Anything else before we go on?
This is a quick question. I'm embarrassed to say, I don't remember, does this predate Christianity, or is it?
Yes, AD? I think by like 500 years. So it's like, he, we're not quite sure, but we think he was born somewhere between 578 and 447 BCE.
Okay.
All right. So then, so he leaves home and he goes on his spiritual path. And this is for like, he's serious and hardcore. So he goes and he studies with one teacher, and, you know, it's really intense meditation. And he does that for, I don't know, maybe a couple of years or something, Alara Kalama. And then Alara Kalama says, you know, all right, you know, you want to teach with me, you know everything that I know. And Siddhartha said no, because he said, I realize this Dhamma, this teaching, he said, leads not to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to stilling, to direct knowledge, to awakening, nor to unbinding, which is Tanisa Rose's translation of Nibbana, but only to reappearance in the dimension of nothingness. So I don't know, you know, exactly what that spiritual path resulted in, but it's like, you can imagine, it's just, okay, I did all this and it's just, it's still not, it's not answering my Samvega. It gives me, you know, I can zone out in meditation or whatever, but I'm, it's not what I was searching for. Sunny goes to another spiritual teacher. And similarly, he masters that teaching. And then he says, you know, similarly, he could teach it, but he said, it does not lead to what he was hoping for, but simply to reappearance in the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. So then he decides to try extreme asceticism. So he just like eats nothing, like sits, you know, in, you know, hours and hours, days and days of meditation. There's descriptions. So interestingly, just as a side note, we glean some of this from sutras where the Buddha is giving teachings and he says, you know, this reminds me of the time when. So he tells the story of what happened to him earlier. And I'm not a scholar, but I believe these are some of the earliest, if not the earliest, autobiographical texts that we have of somebody like telling their story in this way. Anyway, and so he describes how like you could see his like spine from the front and the back. Like he was just, and you'll see some of actually statues of like the of skeletal Buddha, you know, showing this ascetic practice. And it's actually really like let's see, I didn't get a quote. But basically he says, like, he concludes finally, he's like, all right, this is not, is also not getting me where I want to go. And believe, he says, and no one has ever practiced asceticism this hard. So clearly this is not the way. So he thinks, could there be another path to awakening? And according to the story, he's kind of sitting there thinking, and he remembers a time when he was a little kid and his dad was busy with something and he sat under the shade of a tree and he just kind of went into this very easy, natural state of samadhi, this natural kind of non-dual awareness. And he thought, you know, maybe that was onto something there. So then he accepts rice porridge from a woman. I think they says she's like, she thinks he's a spirit, a tree spirit or something. And she offers him rice porridge and he takes it. And it's funny because all of his totally hardcore ascetic buddies are like, he's gone now, he's ruined, he's totally flaked out, he's lost the path. But he just takes a little bit of root, right? Just enough to regain a little bit of strength. And then he tries that form of meditation. So obviously the teaching here is the middle way, which when we get next class to basically the Buddha's very first sermons, he starts out with the middle way. He starts out with the neither extreme. So in this case, it's neither indulgence, like his previous life in the palace, and it's nor is it asceticism. It's not falling into either extreme. And so we apply the middle way in many different circumstances now. Basically, if it looks like there are only two options, then don't get caught. There's another option. Yeah. So then I'll get into his like enlightenment experience, but any comments or questions on the middle way? The idea of the Buddha's ascetic practice. I love how these this imagery and the particularly this next section, you know, myth and imagery and stories speak to us in such a, in a different way than simple explanation or prose or straight teachings, right? So I'm really struck, can't remember exactly where it was. I think it was a article on like compassion in Buddhism, you know, kind of where is the compassion? And you read the Pali Canon and you see the Buddhist teachings and stuff, and it's like, all right, but this article argued, I think really beautifully, that part of the teaching of the Buddha was not just what he said, but what he did. And what he did, which I'll get to, is like, he once he awakened, he taught for like 45 years, and they said he was never alone. So like that, in a way, he manifested perfect compassion throughout his whole life. So I just mean to say that, and that, like, that's why I'm telling this story. Many of you are familiar with it, but you might even want to delve into it more just to have more of these neat images in your mind. So he accepts the rice porridge and he settles down to meditate under a tree. And he says, "Let my skin and sinews and bones become dry and welcome, and let all the flesh and blood in my body dry up. But never from this seat will I stir until I have attained the supreme and absolute wisdom." So he's still kind of hardcore. At this point, this audacity provokes the god Mara. So in this mythological world, there are many gods. There's not a god with a capital G. There's many gods and spirits and supernatural beings and whatever. And the god Mara is the god of the realm of desire. So the realm of, you know, where beings desire and they keep going around and round on the wheel of life because they can't, you know, give up all their grasping. And so he realizes, like, the Buddha might like find a way out of the realm of desire. So he's gonna stop him from awakening. So he sends an unimaginably large army to wage a battle. So there's the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, the enlightenment tree. You know, there's like scary beings and like rocks and lightning and all kinds of stuff, including an elephant 150 leagues high named Girded with Mountains. But Siddhartha remains unfazed. So Mara attacks in other ways. Torrential rainstorm, gale forest winds, a shower of rocks, and dense darkness. So all such attacks prove fruitless. At one point then he says, "Well, who the heck do you think you are that you're just going to, what, you can just attain enlightenment? Like, you're near nothing." So he asks, you know, who is your witness to being able to do this? And the Buddha touches the earth, and the earth bears witness for him. And then at that point, Mara's army's like, they said, this is kind of like a comic book. "No two went the same way, but leaving their head ornaments and their cloaks behind, they fled straight before them." You know, like so fast that they leave their hats behind. So now that the disturbance is over, the Buddha is able to concentrate and awaken. And I describe this in detail. I have a podcast episode on like what unfolded. The idea is that he was able to see his past lives and the past lives of infinitely many beings, and he saw this pattern, right? He saw this pattern because The question, to backtrack a little bit, the question at the Buddha's time, other people had the same question he did, basically, which was, is there anything human beings can do to kind of achieve some peace or some stability? And there were different theories. There were theories that you should do elaborate rituals and placate the gods, and then you might have a better, you know, outcome. There were theories like in Jainism that we are weighed down by karma. It's like a heavy substance. And through fasting and sacrifice, you kind of make this substance lighter, and that kind of and also any harm you do, you accrue more heavy karma. So the Jain monks, you know, they are the ones that like sweep the sidewalk so they don't step on any bugs, and they wear a mask so they don't breathe in any bugs. And the highest form of practice would be to starve yourself to death. So that's a very different version. So the Buddha's looking, he's got the same question, and he realized, like, you know, what happens to people is largely dependent on what they do. Like, it's our choice. It's the choices that we make profoundly affect our experience. And in the Buddhist, you know, literature, it's describing this in very little literal terms, in terms of rebirth, right? So what actions you do, you know, affect what experience you have in this life, but they also affect future lives. I am agnostic about literally rebirth, but you don't have to literally believe in it for this to apply. The way that I would describe it, so I put it in my own modern terms, is regardless of your experience, your circumstances, regardless of your old age, disease, death, loss, fortune, the winds of life, no matter what is happening, your experience is largely dependent on the state of your own mind. So, and the rest of the Buddha's teaching was, and you could do something about the state of your mind. So depending on how you look at it, depending on how you see yourself, depending on what your expectations are, all of that profoundly affects, you know, how you experience life. So, I mean, that's a very modern kind of Zen, like, summary of what the Buddha awakened to. But he awakened to, you know, how we might find some peace in this life, and then also the path. So subsequent classes will be talking about, he taught the Four Noble Truths, recognizing dukkha or dissatisfactoriness, how that arises, how to let it go, and the Fourth Noble Truth is the Eightfold Path. So we will be talking about that. So, questions or comments about that part, Coral?
So, I like the section that Mara shows up after he decides to eat the rice and live in this. Well, I like to use the like world of moderation, because if anybody has ever done anything all or nothing, and then tried to do that same thing but in moderation instead, the moderation part is so much harder. It's so much harder to be like, I'm going to eat, you know, this junk food or the foods that bring me joy in moderation, rather than cutting them out completely. And so I think of that when I'm trying to live my life in moderation and not like do the self-discipline thing that's like way too much. No sugar. It's like, no, I want a cookie. Maybe. And so this really resonates with me in that way.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, and that that the Buddha, I also, that I take from that story of Mara, that he had doubt, like just like we do. I mean, if you think of Mara as kind of enacting all of the barriers that we encounter, you know, there we are something, who do you think you are? Your mind wanders all the time. You're not a Buddhist. Like, you know, that if you, and it's helpful almost sometimes to think of that as like, Mara, I hear you, almost kind of externalizing that doubt and that challenge. Mick?
Yeah, I think like in a similar vein, I really like the Mara part of the awakening story, like, because I'll be sitting and I'll be like, oh man, my foot kind of itches, or like, oh, I'm a little uncomfortable. And I just like, I think of the story and I think of like the kind of determination that the Buddha had for awakening, and the kind of like that it's a reminder to me that it is a struggle and you have to struggle against it. And I don't know, I just like, you know, having like an aspirational story to turn to. And this is the one that I often think of, particularly when it's difficult to sit, because I think of like all the stuff that was happening around him, and I was like, well, he's still sitting, so.
So I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. So are you saying that back in the day in India, there were a lot of people who were unhappy all the time? Everybody was unhappy all the time, except for a few people who weren't smart enough to be unhappy or what. They were comfortable. But then there's this whole, because they have so many spiritual sects that.
I mean, I don't know what the proportions were. I can't imagine it was all that different from ours, in the sense that probably most of the people in the Buddha's time were just like, yeah, whatever with your, you know, dissatisfaction stuff, you know, I just got a new house. Like, you know, I mean, people like life and people like pleasure and people, you know, and you can't really, that's what's so, I mean, another, this part of the story doesn't exactly address it. And yet indirectly, this is why we don't proselytize, right? Because like, what would that involve? That would involve tugging on somebody's sleeve and being like, you're really unhappy, aren't you? Do you know what? You're unhappy. You find your life dissatisfying, don't you? Do you know that you're eventually going to die? You know, I mean, we don't want beings to be unhappy. Yeah. So, you know, it's like, if you feel some vega and you want to do something about it, we're here.
Well, does that mean that the ones who are happy or content or oblivious, however you want to describe it, they have reached nirvana and the rest of us are having problems?
I don't think so. Although, you know, you never know, right? You encounter somebody, I don't know. I mean, I felt kind of, okay, I felt arrogant about having a sense of samvega, like, you suckers, and, you know, I'm the only one who's deep enough to realize that this is screwed up and all that. But then at a certain point in my practice, I don't know, I just kind of looked around at people in my life, like my parents, and like, I think they're just happy, and there's something wrong with me. Like, you know, so I feel like it's where people are on the path is kind of a mystery. Doesn't necessarily, you know, they're Buddhist or they're not Buddhist, or they're spiritual or they're not spiritual. I don't know. And to put it in Buddhist terms, maybe they practiced in a past life and they actually do have a sense of kind of acceptance and peace that I needed to work on. So, you know, I find it kind of crazy making to try to guess what's going on for other people. And
there,
just
there are a lot of people who, in the human race, who are uncomfortable all the time.
Yeah, I mean, and when you isn't somebody that, might claim that they're fine, but if they have an addiction, I would kind of suggest, well, probably not entirely. Or, you know, if people are, this is another aspect where, you know, somebody may pass themselves off as being fine or superior even, and yet if they're a creep, you know they're not. And that's why sometimes I just think, I feel great compassion for Trump. He must be one of the most miserable people in the world. Otherwise, you wouldn't act like that. So. So, one more part of the story, kind of skipping over what the Buddha taught, which is what we'll get to next time. But just in terms of his life story, there are two more nuggets. So one is after he awakened, and he was totally at peace. Like, he was like, I see what causes this kind of spiritual misery, and I let go of that, and I'm good. And he thought, nobody's going to get this. This is just, nobody's going to understand. I'm just going to sit here. He did not intend to teach. He was just going to sit there and live out his life. And according to the myth, the gods begged him to teach. They said, some people will understand. But some people understand. You got to do it. Some people understand. So then he went and he taught like the last guys that he had practiced with. And they didn't want anything to do with him at first. But then he was kind of glowing, and they kind of were like, well, I think he's come on to something. So, you know, from that, I kind of take a little encouragement that like this path and this practice isn't easy. It's not that straightforward. And then at the very end, so then the Buddha taught for like 45 years, age 80, he got old and decrepit, and he was approaching his death. And then finally he died, and he saw it coming, and, you know, he laid down and peacefully, and all disciples came and animals came, and everybody was sad to lose the Buddha. But his last teachings were like, basically, you don't need me. The Dharma, I have left you the Dharma. I have left you the teachings and the practices. You don't need me. So this is very different as from many spiritual traditions and paths, right? Where like there's something kind of redemptive or important about the founder. The founder had something special that we don't have. And that's, I mean, the Buddha was more amazing than most of us will ever be, probably, but he was just a human being. And so he said, you know, here's my Dharma, trust yourselves, be lamps unto yourselves. Not in the sense of like, you know, your small self, just cling to your opinions, but when you practice, you can trust yourself. And off he went. Any last comments or questions? Betty.
Thank you. So this is really interesting, the mythology around, you know, the mythology in these stories. And, you know, this was all written down and created well after the fact. So the story of the god or gods coming to him and telling him to go teach, carry forth the message and, you know, do all the good things you're going to do. You know, I wonder what really happened. You know, what, why did he really decide to go out and teach? Was it, does that kind of go back to what Marv was saying about the sense of compassion that he carried with him from the beginning? You know, it was like, what was going on in his real physical life at the time that caused him to get up and take the message out? That's just interesting to me, how to sort of sift the myth from the reality, you know?
I mean, all I can imagine is that, you know, he was just sitting there and he like, I think he literally like, he just sat in meditation for a week. And all I can imagine that he was like, this is so liberating. This is so wonderful that this would really help beings. Yeah, like Marv said, this would help beings. And also when he sees like, this is something any being can do. This isn't some supernatural attainment that he got. This is something that any being can do. And so maybe even though he was skeptical, he was like, oh, I guess I could try. I could go try those guys. They're pretty spiritually advanced. Maybe they'll get it. And then so I will share the story of his first sermon. So he goes and describes in the Pali Canon Sutta how they're like, oh, here comes Siddhartha, the one who like, you know, betrayed his ascetic vows. But then they like, oh no, he looks like he's got something. Like, and they let him talk and they listen to what he has to say. And like, it isn't even all the way through his sermon where one of them is just like, and then it's just like, and the Buddha's like, you got it. Mm-hmm. All right. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.